Hello and welcome. I am your host, Kirsty, and this is Leadership Odysseys. We're embarking on a mission to bridge the gap between aspiration and reality, offering a raw and unfiltered exploration of the behind-the-scenes challenges that shape true leadership. Join us as we share stories of resilience, turning points, and authentic human experiences that remind us greatness is a product of the entire odyssey, not just the destination. Today, we are thrilled to have Nuala Walsh join us as our esteemed guest. Nuala is a visionary leader, behavior scientist, author, and CEO of Mind Equity Consulting. With an illustrious career spanning over three decades in investment management, banking, and consulting, she brings a wealth of expertise in strategy, reputation management, and culture change to our conversation today. Recognized among the top 100 most influential women in finance, Nuala has held key leadership positions at prestigious firms such as Merrill Lynch, BlackRock, and Standard Life Aberdeen, where she served as the Chief Marketing Officer. Her innovative approach to leadership and understanding of behavioral science has propelled her to the forefront of her field. Beyond her corporate endeavors, Nuala serves on the boards of various nonprofit organizations, including the Global Association of Applied Behavioral Scientists, and was a former vice chair on UN Women. Nuala's insights have been featured in publications such as Forbes, Harvard Business Review, and Psychology Today. A captivating speaker and thought leader, she has delivered keynote presentations at prestigious institutions worldwide, inspiring audiences with her blend of wisdom. Nuala's TED Talk on overcoming indecision has inspired millions around the world, and her recently published book, Tune In, How to Make Smarter Decisions in a Noisy World, offers groundbreaking insights into decision-making in today's fast-paced environment. So join us as we embark on a fascinating journey into the world of leadership with Nuala Walsh. Welcome, Nuala, to Leadership Odysseys.
Thank you so much, Kirsty, and what an introduction. Thank you so much. Very kind.
Oh, well, listen, it is a pleasure to have you join me on the podcast. And, you know, we met, it was probably the best part of a month ago, we'll introduce you, a mutual friend. And I have absolutely loved getting to know more about you and your journey.
Terrific. I look forward to it. It's one of my favorite podcasts. I enjoy your approach and your attitude to all of your guests. So I'm looking forward to it.
Well, let's dive right in. So Nuala, your journey has been nothing short of inspiring. It's been marked with remarkable growth and numerous achievements. So as we embark on this conversation, could you kindly rewind to the starting point of this remarkable odyssey? Because we're eager to delve into the roots of your journey and discover the essence of who Nuala Walsh truly is.
Well, I'm Irish, as you can probably tell from my accent. And I guess I grew up with a family of five girls, believe it or not, which was difficult, I guess.
Five girls.
Irish family.
Yeah, wow. And so where are you positioned in the sibling order of five?
You ask that with a knowing smile, given that we all know about middle child syndrome. Well, that is me in the middle, fighting for my voice. Five girls, but interesting. So five Catholic Irish girls growing up was very interesting for both my parents, I reckon, but also raised by my grandparents as well. So a bit of a different combination to us. But then I guess we all learned there is no typical family these days. Certainly not now.
Oh, there definitely isn't that typical family anymore. And how fantastic to have not only your parents there, but also your grandparents there to be able to influence those foundational years as well.
Yes, yes. Not everybody, I think, is fortunate enough, but my grandparents certainly played a very strong role in all of our upbringing, which was fantastic. And I think it's actually given me years later, an appreciation of looking after the elderly, if you like. So I think I have a particular affinity to looking after people, you know, who don't have family around them, people who live in the community, maybe, who might be on their own. But it's not something that strikes you when you're working, of course, when you're busy in your day job, but certainly where I am now, it's definitely something that I'm much more cognizant of and actually make more of an effort with, which probably surprises everybody, given that when you're so fully focused on a corporate career, you don't typically, you don't find maybe the interest to look around. You're just so busy working.
Oh, it really is, isn't it? And it's only in retrospect that you look back and you look at how you prioritize your time. But those building years where you really are, it's just go, go, go the whole time. The priority is definitely, for a lot of people, their work. They're trying to, you know, move up that corporate ladder. They're trying to study. They're trying to learn and grow personally as well. There's a lot of personal strategies that are in place. And you can sometimes just lose the essence of what is actually happening around you.
So true. That is so true. But maybe COVID in many respects gave people that opportunity to reset and re-examine their priorities and see what really matters. And I think we've all seen that. Started with the Great Resignation, actually. If you recall, there were a lot of people who decided to change tack and decided to take early retirement or just switch careers. So that whole theme of reinvention, I think it's probably what we will come to. But I think COVID was a phenomenal catalyst for people to re-examine what really matters and what they're prepared to tolerate, not really. So I think that's something to consider, the environment and how it affects our decisions at different points in time.
For sure. I could not agree anymore with that. The environment that we're around, you look at this last 5 years of everything that's happened and, you know, the ability to have so much more choice in how we show up every day within the, you know, the corporate landscape as well is just so significantly different. And Nola, from your perspective, going back to those early kind of years, where did it all begin for you? Like, were you this teenager that went, I'm going to be working in the banking industry, you know, leadership is going to be part of my career journey? Was it well thought out, or it's kind of one thing has led to the next?
People who are destination driven and decide they're going to be either a lawyer or a shopkeeper or a journalist at some point. But no, I would say that in my case, I took a very circuitous route. Yeah, through my career. When my first course in college was actually, I wanted to do psychology, and I chose the college over the course. So I chose going to Trinity College to do philosophy, which is interesting, and languages rather than psychology, which actually I kind of preferred, but I didn't prefer the college. So with my first choice, that was my first choice. And so because I didn't want to become a French philosopher, I decided I would actually then embark on the business route. So then I went to UCD, and I did my master's in business studies there. I did 2 years and did a master's in business studies. It's fantastic. But interestingly, when I was finished, before I started working in consulting, I actually did forensic psychology. So I sort of always had that. And I guess as we go through this conversation, everything has come full circle, because now I am using psychology, ironically, today. And when I didn't, actively using it today, when I didn't through those years. But no, then I did forensic psychology, and I was always fascinated with understanding behavior and understanding the human mind. I sort of felt that in my own world, I'd understood, probably didn't, but I thought I did, but I understood the average person's psychology. But I was really interested and curious about deviant psychology, why ordinary people would murder their wives or their parents or their children as well. And the serial killers, which I know fascinates a huge number of people around the world, and I was one of those. So that interest in psychology and deviant psychology in particular, I found fascinating. So I blended that, and then we went on to, I did my first job was actually with PA Consulting, which was a fantastic organization. And that was a great groundwork for financial services, FMCG, pharmaceuticals. The actual work there, I liked the diversity of that work. The one thing that was a catalyst, and again, it goes back to the theme of the circle and how everything is a springboard. I took an opportunity there to work with the World Bank. Now, I was a junior, first year, second year level, and I asked one of the senior partners if I could use my training allowance to join him on a trip to the World Bank in Washington, D.C. So I he agreed, But my reward for that was actually we won the deal, as it were, and the project was 1 year in Tanzania. So I lived in Africa for a year.
Oh, wow.
And what you learn then is it's so difficult to get people to stay in Africa for a year. Well, at that time, you become a career consultant, an African career consultant. So in fact, I worked for a partner in the field who had been there 20 years. So it was go to Ghana was the next opportunity. So I did Kenya and I did Tanzania there. And that was fantastic. And that was actually, ironically, a springboard to join ActionAid when I came back. So everything sort of stems from the first opportunity that you have. And certainly we don't have time to map my whole career and who'd want to listen to that anyway. But you will see that everything does fall to everything else. So I did 5 years in consulting. The last year was with the World Bank. And I didn't want to stay as a career consultant. So I moved into financial services. And so I joined Merrill Lynch. And I absolutely loved Merrill Lynch. My favorite question was, where do you work? So how sad is that? But I loved the brand so much that I loved working for Merrill Lynch. And I stayed there 5-6 years until there was a merger. Yeah, that was a truthful moment.
Oh, isn't it going through a merger? It's definitely an interesting stage of a career path, that's for sure.
Well, Kirsty, as you probably know, when you have, I've had two or three, but that was a moment when, you know, things changed. So we merged with BlackRock. Now, BlackRock was fantastic. BlackRock is now the largest firm on Wall Street with $10 trillion assets under management. We have a fantastic office in Sydney, actually, and have some very good friends there. BlackRock was great experience. But again, then they merged. So then I moved on to Standard Life Investments. Then they merged. And then I decided to go solo. So I sort of fast-tracked that journey there. But 5 years ago, I stepped out of corporate life and set up my own business as a consultant.
Before we dive into the consulting years, there's so many just big nuggets sitting in your career journey, and I think so aspirational for so many people to listen to, of how one thing can lead to the next and the opportunity of saying yes. Like, you know, to go to Africa for a year is just an incredible experience so many of us wouldn't have, and to be able to embrace that and take all the learnings and come back and just dive right into the next stage is phenomenal. What were some of the biggest learnings you got out of, you know, working internationally as well?
I've always been a globe trotter or a global junkie. So since I was 16, 17, I've always visited one or two new countries every year. So I have a fantastic husband who I met around that time, and we went together. So every year, and fast forward to where I am now, we've been to over 100 different countries over that period deliberately, because every year we try and go somewhere new. Now, for example, in America, we've all been to, well, I shouldn't say we've all been, but if you're this side of the world and you're in a global role, you probably have been quite a few times. So I don't even count the countries that I've been to multiple times. I deliberately, and maybe that's cultural curiosity, I deliberately try and add somewhere new to my travel repertoire every year. And I think that that has fueled not only my interest in professional interest in cultures, but an appreciation for diverse cultures, backgrounds, people, and my interest in human behavior as well. So it is all slightly interconnected. The African experience was fantastic. It was easy, actually. Sounds more glamorous than it was. Yes, we got to go on safari every couple of weeks, and yes, I probably did every park that there was, any of the main parks in Africa. But it was difficult. You were working 6 days a week. You were in a dangerous environment. In many cases, there have been a lot of cases of where they call you the Mzungu. You're the outsider. It was high crime rate. There were difficult working conditions. You weren't allowed to drive to the nearest shop. This was in Kenya rather than in Tanzania. And I remember taking the car one Saturday afternoon saying, I'm going to the shop. And I had to have the windows up, and I was in sweltering heat. But it was difficult because there had been a lot of people that had been attacked. And you understand it. And just a very slight diatribe I'll give you. I had been doing that forensic psychology course that I mentioned, and I had a paper that I had to write about whether the environment, you know, whether you can control your own environment. Before I went to Africa, I had decided, well, if you're a strong personality, you can do anything and you can forge your own path. But when I, that was the thesis of the paper that I had to submit. I was writing it in Africa, and I actually decided before I concluded that actually you can't. There were some really clever, smart people there who were actually just trapped. Unless they got an opportunity to get out, they were trapped wherever they were. So it really brought home to me the power of context and how sometimes, even with the greatest personality in the world and the greatest willpower and spirit, you can't always survive your environment and the forces that are against you. Sometimes you can, and there are great success stories, but often you can't.
That is very powerful words there. You reflect on that and you just think it is so very true. And once again, goes back to what you initially started with, the conversation of your environment and the environment that you're around, because you can have that skill and you could have the courage to be able to take on any opportunity. But if you don't have that environment or opportunities around you to even reach out to or network like we do in a huge part of the world, then it really does narrow those chances. And it is down to all of us to be able to help out in any way we possibly can with providing those opportunities outside of where we currently are in our own environments.
You know, just as you've said that, and as we've raised the topic of environment, I'm now drawing the connection with my book, actually. And I didn't quite realize it until we started talking about it now. Like, now I know my book is all about context and the power of the modern noisy world, and we're overloaded and distracted and it's too fast and people are time starved. And my argument is that the context operates against us unless we choose to proactively reconsider what we're doing, because the past, just as the individuals in Africa in some cases can't get out of that environment, even when it's really corrupt and there are no resources, that equally in the world that we're in now, it's so fast, it's very difficult to overcome misjudgment and the risk of misjudgment unless we proactively set back that environment is against us and do something about it, even though we all know the weight of unconscious bias does set the world against us in many ways. And we are vulnerable to tuning out all of these voices that really matter. So there is an analogy there, actually, between our own individual power to overcome things in our mind, because you do have power over your mind. And the more you focus, the more you concentrate on what is in your mind, you may not be able to control your company. You can't control what your boss does, and you might influence them. But there are many things, as you and I know, that are just out of your control in a corporate world or in an industry. But you can't control what you do and how you think and the decisions that you make, no matter what level you're at. And that is something that I think is really, really important, and people think about sufficiently the decision, how important decisions that you make in terms of how they impact other people.
That's right. How you stand in the world, what your values are, and what you stand true to, I think, as well. And being able to be extremely open-minded, because, yes, different circumstances for everyone. And everyone, I don't think there's a single person that doesn't face some sort of challenge within their career or their personal lives. But it definitely does come down to the individual in how they show up and build a level of resilience and a strong mindset to be able to overcome adversity and to be able to still be kind in the world and have a really open mind and different perspective and not just a closed perspective on their point of view.
I think that is the theory. Practice is completely different. And it's not just our lack of intention, because we only want to be that kind, thoughtful, open-minded individual. But the problem is that we blind spots and deaf spots, and we're subject to confirmation bias, and we default to truth. So by definition, we are, unless we acknowledge that we are faced with those triggers that really turn us against ourselves, and in many cases are the cause of really, really high consequence, I think it is incredibly difficult. I mean, you only need to look at any of the examples. Look at a court case. There's some fantastic research that suggests that jurors make this incredible rush to judgment. Now, we all know about first impressions, and of course, we all wrongly rush to judgment when we see people or hear people. Court of law, a juror takes an oath to do the right thing and balance the evidence and reflect sufficiently, and all these things that we know a juror is obliged to do. ethically and morally and socially and ethically, I guess. But the studies have suggested that when jurors have been asked about what were their initial impressions and what were their initial conclusion before they'd heard anything, you know, they might decide that someone's guilty or innocent, or that they, you know, guilty of manslaughter or whatever the case may be. The problem is that in 5% of cases, people didn't change their mind. Now, we've all watched long trials and realized the weight of evidence. Yes, it's difficult. Yes, it's hard to decipher. Yes, there are compelling witnesses. But if the vast majority of jurors don't change their mind, what does that tell us? That says that they are as guilty of this confirmation bias, which is one of the many, many judgment killers that we face. It's a real problem, and we face it every day. And I think the more successful individual is someone who tries to recognize that in their corporate life. So they can see it in themselves, yes, but also the ability to spot it in other people and to put in guardrails against it happening. And I think that's one of the most important leadership assets that somebody can have. But the reality is that people tend to not think about this sufficiently because, as I said, we live in this fast-paced, overloaded, digitally distracting world.
Yeah, and it's very reaction, like it's very in that moment, quick reaction, you've got to move on to the next thing, and not actually taking that time to, one, ask more questions, but also remove the noise to have a clear view and not have a response at that particular point in time.
Well, that's exactly right. And actually, ironically, there are times when, as you say, you don't want to overreact. But if you consider something like whistleblowing, for example, and I have a paper on whistleblowing, so it is a subject that I find fascinating, because we all know that the right thing to do is to speak up against wrongdoing. Now, you might be in a meeting and somebody may pass an inappropriate remark, something else. And the typical call is, do you laugh? Do you say something? Or do you just let it go and ignore it and hope somebody else will? Which is, of course, the classic bystander effect. And we've all been bystanders. Now, sometimes when companies are trying to encourage people to speak up and have a psychologically safe environment, ironically, as you say, the encouragement is to do it in the moment. Pass a comment in the moment. You would never aggressively call somebody out, but you might say, oh, did somebody mean to say that? Or we used to say when that happened, rightly or wrongly, it'd be time to call HR, and we'd laugh. The point was made, and we knew what that meant. That meant, whoops, I shouldn't have said that. Or you might just say, excuse me. I think that's a terrific one. To say these two words. If someone says something that you find kind of unacceptable and you don't go on to, be a drama queen over it, but you want to register it in some way, if you use those two simple words, excuse me, you can say it in any tone you want, excuse me, people will know, have I said something wrong, or is there something wrong with someone said, and you automatically shift the dial in terms of the tone and tenor of a particular conversation. But that's something that most leaders are now talking about, trying to encourage people to have a voice. But when you have a voice, the company obviously needs to be able to deal with that appropriately.
Why do you think so many people do struggle? I mean, from personal experience, I would say that observing, or once again, when you're looking back over your time, over the decades of working with different teams, that there probably is a level of, it comes with maturity and it comes with experience and it comes with you identifying your own self-worth along that journey as well, from a personal mindset perspective, to go, okay, well, that's not tolerable. That's not actually appropriate. But why do you think so much is tolerated in corporations, and why leaders aren't actually having more discussions around this?
Yes, Kirsty, I think it's actually very clear why people aren't doing it. One, there's the individual, and then two, then there's the culture. So first, the individual is self-interested. He wants to get paid and promoted, that's why you're in court, and recognized. You know, it may not be always money, but you want to be recognized. That's why we work, why we post tweets, that's why we publish articles, that's why we consult with clients, why we, you know, do anything that we do. We all seek an identity of some description. So whether it's the financial incentive or the social incentive, it's incredibly strong. Who wants to be unpopular? No one wants to be that troublemaker, that maverick. Therein lies the problem, because we're labelled troublemaker and maverick if you speak up. Suddenly we want to be liked. So our fundamental need to be liked overwhelms everything else. Add that to the rational self-interest of you don't want to jeopardize your promotion or you don't want to annoy the boss. I mean, who doesn't have those feelings? Well, he does. Of course they do. So, but then you pit that against doing the right thing. Notice in a meeting, the person who does it, and we've all been in a meeting when someone has said, oh, we shouldn't have said that, or someone has stood up for Mary who isn't in the room. And I guarantee you that in your mind, you think, they've done the right thing. I should have done that. And we know what happens sometimes when you are not the one to do it. So the reason that we don't do it is this rational self-interest. Bring that in culture. So you've got the individual that may be nice, kind person, but maybe they may not just not have the courage in the moment to do it. They may be intimidated by the group. They may have low hierarchical status. They may fear the consequences, etc. And then the culture then is about the minute somebody speaks up, what happens? Consider the Enron case of Sharon Watson. She found something wrong and suspected that there was something, that there was an issue. Told her boss, not even in public, this was in a private respondent, told her boss, raised the red flag, didn't want to know. He basically tried to get rid of her on the back of that. So there you have an individual trying to do the right thing, raising a flag, expecting a reward, getting a pat on the back, which she says herself. In no way did she expect to eventually be sidelined, minimized, and she eventually left. But she's not alone. There are many, many cases where this happens. So your question, why don't they? It's culture, it's individual, and it's the culture. And the reason that leaders don't encourage it, do now because they sort of have to, is they're afraid of the consequences. Consider a CEO of a company who has a sexual harassment case against them, and there are plenty of them in the papers now. We read about them all the time now. So people are now brave, people in positions of power or media figures, we're all being held to account, or are they being victimized in many ways, something they said 10 or 20 years ago. So in many ways, there's almost a trend towards let's pack somebody out. And if someone has said something in the past, sometimes it is very legitimate, but it's not always legitimate. And I think we've had many actors in the public eye where they've been brought to court and found not guilty, which is horrendous. And tears at their exoneration, knowing what a horrendous experience they've had. So the very difficult answer. And so when you ask that question about anything like that, the answer will always be it's a mix between cognition and culture.
And it really is, I suppose when you look at leadership, and a lot of people don't start their careers thinking that they're going to end up in leadership positions, but it really is psychology. Like I give you credit of, you've not only just gone at the beginning part of your career, but continued that learning on throughout. And that would have brought significant value to the organizations that you're working in. There is so much opportunity for leaders to be able to go back and study and to really build their skill set in understanding others and the impact they have with their words and just tone in general in leading organizations.
You're right. And I was very lucky towards the latter half of my career. I had one boss who very generously supported my first trip. Now, as an executive, we all get annual training. I think I mentioned in my very, very early career, I used that training allowance to do the World Bank trip. Well, this time I really wanted to do executive education at a high level. So I wanted to do a Harvard course or a Stanford course in leadership. So what I suggested was that I would use, again, 2 years. I'd use 2 years training allowance expenses. But anyway, my boss allowed me to. So I allowed me to do it. And then I got on a pattern. So 1 year I would do a leadership training course. Next one I would do something more typical in my world, if you like. So I always alternated. But over the course of 5, 6, 7 years, I did courses at Harvard, Stanford, MIT, Kellogg. And I was incredibly lucky that he supported that. I really was. And I do give him credit for that. In many ways, he wanted to keep me happy as well. And it did make me happy. And I came back and I always had millions of ideas. And I always had something I wanted to implement. And I always produced a paper on, here was my proposal. I wanted to change the culture. So I think he had to tolerate that I was going, he knew I was going to come back with lots of ideas. But there was one course in particular, I told him he shouldn't have sent me on it. It was by Bill George, called Authentic Leadership. What it did was it asked you, why are you doing what you're doing? Should you be doing something else? And it was one of those that, like we mentioned about COVID, it sort of made you think, why am I doing this? I really love this. Do I really want to be doing this in 10 years' time? And that sort of set me on a path to where I am today, to now that I am doing what I want to do. I am writing and lecturing in human behavior, which is something I love doing, and working with clients in this space. But he put me on that path. And it is something that I would encourage anybody in any organization. Every leader will tell you they don't have time for training. But then when they go on it, they absolutely love it. We're all too busy for everything. We're all too busy for holidays. But, you know, we have to take the time out to be a better leader. And it is something, certainly I prioritize those courses, but I encourage it in my team. My team, there was never a course that they asked to go on they didn't get, because I valued education. And maybe that goes back to the Irish upbringing, where it's all about education and 2-3 degrees. A lot of people, you know, have in Ireland. We do put a premium on that. So I think it comes full circle, as I said before. But that leadership encouragement, to encourage your team to take those courses, and sometimes when they don't, to not mandate it, but almost say, at one point in my career, I did have my business manager who tracked everyone on the team, have they done a course? Because it mattered. And I knew my team were just fantastic, really, really fantastic. But they were so busy trying to, you know, do good for the company that they weren't doing good for themselves. And that is a common theme in any employee, that you don't do the right thing for yourself.
And it really does start with yourself, right? You have to invest in yourself so that you can be the best version of yourself for everyone else, and bring the pure energy and productivity back into the company by actually having that time and investing in you.
That's right. And the investment in yourself is worth a huge amount. What happens is that a lot of people wait to the end of their career to do that, which, you know, has its own rewards, but it is a mistake. I think it's a mistake. It's a missed opportunity for sure, because you're not investing in yourself. And at the end of the day, you want a more evolved leader. Nobody really wants a workhorse. You want a workhorse temporarily, maybe, if you're on a project. But as a leader, look at Warren Buffett, any of these people, they read extensively every day. And they say that they devour books because it broadens their mind. And it's true. And the problem is, as we said already, you just don't make the time for this. When you're working too hard, you're narrowly focused. It's missed opportunity, but also tune out what matters. You don't hear what people are saying. You don't listen to what people are saying because you're so focused on doing the job at hand.
Oh, very, very, very true. And, you know, I think there's a lot of reflecting we all need to really do in that space. But also, you know, that key question that you said, why are we doing what are we doing? It's a hard question to answer. And it's one we, you know, everyone should be asking themselves every single day, so that they can really get to that defining moment to go, this is what my heart desires as well. This is, you know, what's going to bring me joy, and it's going to shape your whole future forward. It is a very, very powerful question to be able to contemplate.
But not everybody has the luxury of that, Kirsty. So people need to earn a living. People need to feed their families and feed themselves. So what I would suggest in that case is, it's almost your life is a jigsaw. And, you know, yes, corporate life takes up a huge amount of it, or whatever, wherever you work at, it mightn't be corporate, but your workplace takes up a huge amount of that. But you can always supplement. You can always supplement a jigsaw piece in something. Of course, you have your hobbies. But when clients do this profile map of where their headspace is, in a lot of cases, when they're on that career ladder, driving forward, hungry for success, you know, 80% might be work, 10% might go to family, 2% might go to yourself. So your hobbies and your passions fall out the window. You convince yourself that your passion is your job. It's not going to be much comfort when you're finished, because we all know that companies like to fire people too. And no matter who you are and what level you're at, you are in that firing line just as much as anybody else, regardless of any delusions that you might tell yourself. You, that is where you are. And if you don't have this cushion, if you don't have fallback, you will never have that resilience that you need to bounce back should something go wrong, or should you need to find employment somewhere else, or have the courage to do something differently. So it is a luxury, but it's an essential look. It's an essential component of well-being and long-term success, in my opinion.
Could not agree anymore. I think that's, you know, as I said before, like wonderful advice to be able to really pass on for all of our audience, but the next gen of leaders really coming through, just the power of actually finding that personal time and really navigating that space to be able to build a very successful career, but also that sideline of who you are. And it's not necessarily a side hustle. It's just growing and being able to actually map out that personal strategy to have time to learn different skills within, you know, outside of the work environment. And to be able to bring that into the work environment also gives a new level of confidence overall for so many people. But I am going to ask you, Nuala, because your journey was just so fast-paced in these remarkable companies that you have worked for. You were actually named the top 100 most influential women in finance. Am I correct?
Among another 100, yes, in one year. Yes, that was. That was nice, to be fair. That was good recognition for all the work and effort that I had made. So that was good.
That is remarkable. And you also had another big moment that was really sitting in your career that I am really intrigued to find out not only about how it came to be, but also about the pure feeling that you felt in this experience, because you've had a standout experience that really will capture the attention of many. And that was the ability to go and interview Bill Clinton. So could you share with us, what was that experience like? And what was the most memorable moments of that interview?
Well, it was a standout moment. One word that I would probably use to summarize it was peril, Kirsty. So in the moment, and that just goes to everybody's nerves of doing it. I'll back a tiny bit. He was a guest speaker at an investment conference. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to get the gig to do the interview. I spent 6 months researching. Well, I rehearsed beforehand, but researching him, his life, everything. My husband laughed and said there were three people in our marriage for quite a while there. All I did was talk Bill, research Bill, because what his team had warned me was that when he gets on stage, he had an address. So I should preface, he had an address to make and his remarks, but then I would interview him afterwards. So, the interview went on for a very long time. So when I interviewed him afterwards, I had been warned that it doesn't matter what question you ask, he'll just go off on a tangent and he'll answer whatever. So you as a podcast host know how difficult that is to rein someone back in to a given topic. When I felt there was no way I could just go up there and go on to question two, she'd answer question one. It was just too stark. So I felt that I had to know, and maybe that was part of my, you know, my back, I had to know not everything about him, almost as much as I could, as much as my brain could absorb before I went in on that day, because I would be more comfortable and I would be able to do my best. I had questions I wanted to ask. I wanted to get to know the person rather than the politician. So I didn't want to ask his views about the state of America in the 21st century or his views on foreign policy or the greenback. And even though my colleagues, I'm certain, did. I said, well, you can read that in the book or read it in the paper. I thought this was a rare, rare, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to do it. And it's something hilariously, I actually didn't tell that many people about. I felt it was so big in my own mind that it was such a huge thing to do that, yes, it would have had bragging rights, but it was almost so big in itself. I didn't even say it. It was so big in my mind. So it was an interesting thing. It was terrifying because there were so many expectations. It wasn't the meeting of them at all. It wasn't even the audience, because I was used to that. I didn't mind that. It wasn't the intimidation factor. I didn't mind that. it was that I really wanted both to do myself proud. I wanted to get through to him in some way. I wanted that right bit to come out. So I was very pleased. I did manage to do that throughout the interview, at one point in particular. But I would say also that it was the hour beforehand was probably the worst hour ever. And it was interesting. I could write a book on it, and you know, maybe I will add it to something at some stage. But because it was a very long story, and there were so many learnings and so many intricacies in A, how I got to do it, B, the actual doing of it, and all that you can take away from someone like that. I mean, I have huge admiration for him. I slightly felt sorry for him, if anything, because someone who had achieved so much still had to play the party line. If I asked a question, did he really have to like give me a party answer? Does it matter for everything? But it did matter because Hillary was running for president, so it kind of did matter. But I thought, surely you can speak your mind now and you don't have to give political nuance to everything. But, you know, that's, I guess, the life of a politician. And if you look at Chelsea Clinton, now Chelsea does the exact same. So it was a fascinating experience. It was one of the best things I've done. But I felt I'd done other similar things, but it was certainly, someone said to me when I finished, you know, to the professional highlight and something I would never forget. And what I wanted to do was give the audience something that they would never forget. And I think I did. I think when people came around, I think I gave them a lifetime memory.
That's fantastic. And what was that pure feeling you did have at the end of the interview, especially with so much preparation that you put into that interview?
Pure relief. The CEO came up to me and gave me a big hug afterwards. I don't think I'd ever, he wasn't a very tactile person. It was odd to see him being so tactile. I think he's probably relieved I didn't let him down in front of all of the peers, you know, so, and all of his clients. So pure relief. It wasn't joy or pride or things that you would expect. It was nothing but relief. Thank God it's over. And you can see it in my face on the video when I'm finished. It's like, thank God it's over.
And I'm sure that the audience absolutely were just holding true to listening to every point of that discussion. And I'm sure the energy was just thriving across the room. But did you get to capture that energy in the room while having that discussion, or it was just all too much at the time?
You mean, did I absorb the room's energy? Oh my God, absolutely. The leaders were spellbound. And when he finished, a standing ovation, but the buzz before he came in, buzz afterwards was enormous. And then for the dinner afterwards, and people were just on such a high. So I did feel it. And you know, my team were there. It's funny, but my team had worked terribly hard, and in the business hadn't been, you know, marketing wasn't seen as a very, you know, in an investment management company, marketing isn't the top of the pops. You know, it's the risk management teams or the compliance teams that always get the front and center. By doing some of these events, my team got a massive halo effect, and they were hugely proud. They were hugely proud, I guess, that their leader was able to, you know, do this. And a few of them said that, and I think that was terrific. And I made sure that they all got to meet him. So my whole team got to meet him, my PA, everybody. In addition to the VIP clients, of course. So they were first, but I made sure that my team got in there and they got something out. And I always did that no matter what event I had. If there was a VIP there or a great opportunity, I made absolutely sure that it wasn't a case of, you know, the leader gets all the spoils or the seniors get all the spoils. Everyone in my team, anyone who worked really hard on these events, always got part of the credit, whether it was that sort of an event or sponsoring the Ryder Cup or the British and Irish Lions. They all got, if they worked on it, they all got some of the, not just the credit, but they all got some of the fun as well.
Well, the pure joy of being part of such a big initiative, and the ability to know for yourself as a leader as well, that it wasn't about you, it was about all of you together as a team. And when you work together as a team, this is what you can actually deliver. And so it's a huge part of saying, let's celebrate the wins as a collective.
We had a big event, maybe some or a big occasion every year or second year. We always had an event, and we always had a competition up to upgrade it. Who had the best idea? So we voted for the best ideas to improve it. or something. It might have been some client, a small thing, but it was something made it even more special for people. And the problem is you raise the bar so much, it keeps getting higher and higher and higher. You think, seriously, are we going to have the next event on the moon? It was the next event. It was just got the level just growing and growing. But it was the best team I ever had, and I'm still friends with them now. You know, they gave me everything, and I think I gave them loyalty at the end as well. So a really fantastic team, and still take my hat off to every one of them.
Oh, they really do. And I know it's a bit cliche to say, but, you know, your team, I suppose, it's not necessarily they become family, but you spend as much time with your team as you do with your family. So the value alignment and the ability to really just be able to push each other and catch each other and just nurture each other as a team is very, very powerful in those relationships that you do take for the rest of your life and really hold on to.
Yes. And you're lucky if you are able to take from every company you work with, if you're able to take some of those relationships with you. You don't always, and you know, in many respects, you've got politics and you've got competitive individuals, and they're not friendships. They're not things that you'll take with you. And in fact, you leave them fully behind in some cases. But when you're able to do that, I think it's win-win. And I think, as you say, sometimes you're lucky enough and you can bring those people with you, you know, for the rest of time. And ironically, even now, I work with some of them. I did a session for one of the girls. One of the girls works in a major bank. And she invited me in to do a talk on the book. And it was incredible. It was so interesting for me. There I am giving a think about book to all of her. She works very closely with the CMO of this massive bank. And there I am trying not to let her down, and because she's invited me in and this is her gig. But it was just, as I said, the world just goes round and round. It's a very small world. It was a great experience that I was able to do something, and they absolutely loved it. And because they loved it, of course, she was beaming, and she thought, well, A, probably thank God, what a relief. And B, you know, I made her good. They liked it. It would have been different if they didn't.
How rewarding for you as well. And so you're going to have to tell us all about this book. And, you know, after this remarkable career, what was that changing moment for you to transition over into a different landscape where you have now? You've launched a book, you've had your TEDx talk, you've got a consulting company. Where's the big shift that actually happened there for you?
I think we said earlier on, are things calculated out? They're not really. I always said once upon a time I would do a book. So it's not that the idea was foreign to me. When I did the master's at the London School of Economics in behavioral science, maybe 5-6 years ago, believe it or not, even in that space, in the lecturers, that is, and the guest speakers, I was a mature student, obviously, compared to everybody else. They all had books, Kirsty. And I was like, oh yeah, that's still what we do. We all have books. So I thought, and so it wasn't, so in my first work, or my book, nobody has done one who was working, but in the academic world, they all have them. So started, and it wasn't that I thought about doing it then, I started writing for, and well, I did my research. It started because when I did my research on whistleblowing, it got published in the Harvard Business Review. Now, that was slightly planned because I knew that whatever thesis I did, I wanted something that I could make some PR on it. Because I was trying to build my business. I was starting off my consulting firm. And I did think, well, I'm doing some research now. If I make it PR worthy, and whistleblowing was at that topic, and I was interested in it, I might be able to publish an article on it. Now, in university, they talk about publishing articles. They talk about publishing in a scientific journal. I wanted to publish it in a management journal, rather than I wasn't going down the academic route. But therefore I did the whistleblowing, and I tried very hard. I can tell you, it was not easy to get into the Harvard Business Review. The editors must have, I don't know what, when they saw my piece, but anyway, they accepted it but they changed it and they edited it, and you get heavily edited in many cases. So it's not an easy journey to get something into those journals. So anyway, because of that, I then started to write. I think I got invited by Psychology Today. They were obviously looking for people in this space. I had been lecturing in the London School of Economics and other places, just in my, as an extra. And then I started with Forbes. I joined the Forbes Business Council and I started publishing there. I'm a regular writer for Inc. magazine in the US for small business. And that was a very good groundwork for honestly teaching me how to write. But I'm a lot better now than I was before I started. Mightn't be for everyone, but I think writing is an art. And I would still say I've a long way to go on that base compared to some other people. But I'm a lot better than others. And there are people who are still a lot better. So I still think even that, it's like painting, I guess. It's a constant source of learning and improvement. But anyway, the book is quite simply about misjudgment. So it's called Tune In, but I could have called it Tuned Out, because it's actually about leaders who tune out. It might have been, and it's deliberately about plotting why people feel unheard and why we tune out the voices and the people and the information that really matters. And so I provide a practical framework to help people tune in by plotting 10 different misjudgment traps. So really just so people can make regret-free decisions. I've got fantastic examples. My editor said that he had never in his life seen so many examples. You know, it must have been that research basis. So you certainly, my husband read it and thought, this is actually quite interesting. I think he thought he was getting a textbook. So I was pleasantly surprised that he was learning something that was actually kind of interesting. I'm thinking, well, why are you so surprised? So my family have it now. My sister is in Australia, so she will be critiquing it. So I'd be interested to see what my family think about it. But so far, the feedback has been good, and the endorsements have been fantastic. I've been very lucky with the endorsements that I've got from, you know, a couple of big names, and people really seem to like it because it is not only practical, but points to something, and the stories are good, that it points to problem that people have that they're not aware of and teach them how to think differently, which is the deaf spots. So we all know what a blind spot is. Well, a deaf spot is, you know, quite simply the fact that, you know, you don't think, you can't hear what really matters. So it's a psychological term that's very similar, but it relates to what we hear. So that's it, I guess, in a nutshell. You make better decisions, you want to avoid pain-free regret. I do guarantee that you will make fewer mistakes with it than without it. Because if you don't have it, you still make mistakes, but you certainly will make fewer, because it is a manual and it is a roadmap in many respects of the human mind of where we go wrong when we're chasing power or tempted by ethics or in fast-paced, in a hurry, in crisis, uncertain, etc., etc. All of these conditions and situations that we face. But I could be a long time talking about the book, Kirsty. So I shall pause. I've been here for a very long time.
I was going to say that the best part of it is that you don't only have the research. I mean, you've got all these years of studying yourself. You've got all the research you did prior to writing the book. You've also got the career journey where you've lived and breathed the space of company cultures and reputations and change management as well. So you've got, you know, the balance of it all to actually create something that becomes an absolute tool for people to use as they navigate their career journeys as well.
Yes. And you are never stuck for opportunities. And I think sometimes maybe we don't always find them. We don't look for them and we don't pause long enough to find them. So anything that's a disadvantage, you can always find an advantage in there somewhere. And I think that's pretty important too, that yes, you can be tuned out, but when you tune in, the benefits are absolutely enormous. It really gives you a power and an insight into people and human behavior that other people don't have. So if you're looking for a competitive edge, this is it. Understand human behavior, apply it to business, apply it to the problems that you see, the behaviors that you don't like in others. Just analyze them and understand them. And it gives you a power over that situation. And you mentioned resilience earlier. It gives you more resilience.
Yeah, it definitely, gosh, it's opened my mind to just think, yeah, the power of even contemplating to go back and study and really, yeah, understand so much about the human mind, but the impact that actually has within the leadership scope and corporations in general across the world, and then the impact then that flows through to the economy of people being able to have these healthy workplaces to be in, to be able to have leaders that are going to empower people and help them thrive, and people being able to have the psychological safety within the workplace. It's absolutely critical.
Yes, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said impact. This is all about impact and influence.
Yeah, and what would be for you success from this outside of general sales or being at the number one in position for book? What does success look like for you with people reading this book and the difference that hopefully everyone can make in this world?
You know, it isn't about sales. It isn't about being the number one calling card that someone will say, okay, maybe you've got some credibility, maybe you know something, maybe I'll listen to you. But really, really, it's fleeting. It doesn't give you joy. It doesn't make you happy. My colleagues, my former colleagues, my family, my clients, strangers turn around and say, you know, I took your advice on chapter on power or risk or identity or ethics, and it made a difference to my life. What's worth more than that? Or I changed my decision, you helped me prevent a disaster, or I was going to do X, but I read your book and I did Y, or now I think differently about Z. That for me, I think, is enough. If I hear some good feedback about stories like that, or even I just really enjoyed the book, don't mind that either. So I enjoyed the book and it gave me a lot to think about. I think that's enough, Kirsty. Wow, don't get me wrong.
It sure is.
If some leader of some country and you hold power has done that, and it comes from and they do something material with it, well, wouldn't it be all the better? But I'll take it wherever it comes from. I do think it's useful for people in power. I do think it's useful for CEOs. I think it's for everybody, quite frankly. My sister says to me, is it for me? I said, it's for anybody. Do you make decisions? Well, then yes, it's for you.
I think it's even for teenagers, to be honest. I've got a couple of teenagers in my household, and it definitely is something that I would like them to read. So as they navigate that stage of life where they're starting to have to make their own decisions and, you know, where they're going in the world and, you know, whether it's uni or work and all these things, it's definitely going to be a tool I will be introducing to my two teenagers.
Oh, well, fantastic, because it does show, Kirsty, it at least will make them more aware who they're listening to. And, you know, when I say who, it could be experts, too much emphasis on experts or idols or your bosses, and they're discounting the maverick voices, or they're listening to the first voice or the most popular voice or the fastest voice or the loudest voice. It will give them a different way of thinking. What voice am I actually listening? And there's a lovely map in it in the book, actually, where people can just pick out the voice. Oh, I'm listening to this voice more than the other voice. And it just gives them a different way of thinking about, you know, you can think about it in the abstract way, voice of greed or conscience or convenience, comfort, or you can think of a practical voice like the boss, the celebrity, you know, the expert. So you can kind of take it on two levels, and practical, the abstract or the more tangible that people can relate to. But it operates at both levels. And I think that will give people pause to think about misinformation that's in their minds, not just about fake news, but listen, if we consider people's behaviors and think twice, second guess, not jump to conclusions, you are adding a source of misinformation into your mind, and it's as bad as any fake news. And by definition, actually, you create false memories. So, which I have another article written on, but that is basically the thrust of this. So I hope your teenagers enjoy it and make some good decisions on the back of it, or at least think more differently about how they're going to make a decision and then what conclusion they actually make.
They definitely will when I give them the opportunity to have a read through, and they're probably going to ask when they, you know, go back and listen to this podcast as well for a coffee table book of all the places that you've traveled, because that's the biggest decision for their world right now. And I would love to probably hear all the different destinations that you've traveled to in the world. One other question that, you know, really want to be able to ask you is, you know, you've had this career where there has been a lot that's probably happened for you behind the scenes so that you can show up as the best version of yourself. And whether that's now in your consulting, as you're out there and consulting to some of the Fortune 500 companies or organizations, what are you doing behind the scenes for you? What do you do every day, or do you have a schedule, or do you have sports, anything that you get involved in that helps build your mindset and resilience so that you can show up as the best version of yourself?
It's a really good point. At the moment, I'm probably too focused on marketing a book. You realize that when you write a book, that it's not about the writing, then you have to market the book. So I didn't realize that was a precondition of the whole thing, naively. So what I'm trying to do for myself, I do run. I run, I won't say every day, I try to run every day. I run as much as I can. And when the sun comes out, I actually sit in the garden a lot. So I finally got my garden re-landscaped after years of neglect. So I absolutely love the garden. I love the sun. And that's what I enjoy doing most. I also care for my mother more than I ever have before. She's 85 now. For myself, well, it isn't for her, but it's also, I get a lot of satisfaction out of, as I think we started with this, out of caring for the elderly. You see how dependent they are on you. It's really sad, actually. It is really sad, but you see how dependent they are on you. And I like to do small things that make a huge difference. And all you need for the elderly, a little means a lot, and it really does. And my poor granny, God love her, before she passed away on her deathbed, said, "We really need to be better to the elderly." And I'm thinking, gosh, you're giving us a nice guilt trip now, aren't you? But she meant, and she did, she did live with people, so she wasn't lonely in that sense of the word, but maybe in her mind she was, as you get more cognitively impaired. Maybe we don't realise that you're lonelier in your mind, even though there might be people physically present. So it was just something to think about. So I do that for me, and that's a bit, and I do enjoy the writing. So I do enjoy that when I'm not under pressure. So I do that for me. And I think at this stage, after 30 plus years working for companies, working for other people, I do it for me, and I have a better family life. And I'm not sure I have better work-life balance, but it's my choice. That makes the difference. It's my choice whether I do it or not.
Choice is a big part of that. I think in life in general, the biggest thing that gives a sense of freedom or success is the ability to have choice. It's the ability to choose how you're spending your time. It doesn't mean stop, and it doesn't mean slow everything right down, but the ability to choose the hours of the day and how you're going to prioritize your time, for whether it be with your loved ones, your family, friends, travel, you know, time for yourself to do exercise, write books, consult. It's balancing it all and having that freedom of choice, which is a game changer for so many.
It is. And but it's something that you really only get after you've gone on the journey. So maybe you can expect it later in life. We always have choice. Now, we always have choice throughout life, but you have the choice not to do things and not to go be in corporate life, I think towards the end of your career, after you've, and maybe you've earned that right, but you know, at this stage. But I think, don't forget, people have choice not to stay with the company, or to stay with the company, or to make pivots. And pivots are things that people can do at any stage. You've got so many fantastic examples in life. I mean, look at Pope. Is it Pope Francis? I think who changed his life. He was Jorge Mario Bergoglio. He was a bouncer by day and by night, and a janitor by day, before he ended up leading the Catholic Church. So that's one example, and there are plenty more. I think Vera Wang is another one. I think she was an ice skater who didn't qualify for the Olympics, and of course now she's a global fashion icon. Yeah. They're successful, but there are plenty of people who change track all the time. Mid-career, early career, late career. So I would encourage people to do that as they so wish.
That's one for everyone to take on board and know that those options are out there when you're asking yourself the questions and making those key decisions for yourself throughout your journey as well. Now, Nola, as well, you had the TEDx. Can you give our audience an overview of that feeling of walking out on stage to deliver your first TEDx experience?
Then I would say that feeling before I went out was horrendous. I don't think people enjoy public speaking. I certainly don't. I manage it very well. I do it. But anybody likes those moments before they go on stage. I know none of the big speakers that we ever had enjoyed it either. I enjoyed the fact that it was done, that I did it, that I didn't. I think I stuttered once in it. But by and large, I was very pleased with my material. So I liked the material, and my anxiety, which was there, was just to make sure that I got the message out properly and I didn't mess up getting it out. Because you've got no notes and you have no... So you are literally there for 18 minutes going from memory. And we all know that memory decreases over time. So, you know, I was anxious from that point of view. When I did it, when I was delivering it, but I hadn't learned. And your secret weapon is rehearsal. You rehearse. And then you have the confidence that if you do something wrong, it doesn't matter. But if you know it, you know what you're saying in your head. And that's it. That really is the only best tip ever. If you rehearse it and know it well enough yourself in advance, I think that's everything. That makes it much easier. But it was a great thing to do, but it was a very difficult thing to do. So anyone who's thinking about it, I would not underestimate the time involved. And if you look at people who talk about their experiences, they don't admit, you don't just rock up and do it. You are investing time in doing it.
You know? Is it part of a craft? Like, is it part of the ability to go out there and, yes, you want to have that perfect speech where you remember every word, but is it also part of what you do and what you're living and breathing and talking about your passion? So is it a different feeling of really just connecting with the audience out there at that particular point in time?
That's a fantastic question. Before I went on, what I told myself to make myself feel better was, this actually isn't about me. Actually, the truth of it was, I did want to help people avoid. It was about indecision, how to overcome indecision. I did want to help people overcome indecision because we all know that it's crippling when it happens and it's dreadful. So, and I knew that I had techniques and a way for people to think about it differently. So when I thought, I'm actually going to help all of these people in the room with this, because I know I can, I know my material was useful, relevant, interesting. And so when I thought about, I'm actually helping people in front of me, it did make a difference. It made a psychological difference in terms of what I was doing. So I'm thinking, they didn't know what I was going to say. I thought, my message was, once you're confident in your material and you're confident in the message, I think that made the difference. And then I think that made a difference. And it makes a difference to people when you are making those large scale presentations.
Well, Nuala, I have to say it's been phenomenal having you join me on Leadership Odysseys. You truly have a spectacular odyssey. Before we finish up, though, I am going to ask for a couple of words of wisdom that you can pass on to the aspiring leaders, founders of tomorrow. What would that be that you would like to share?
I could encapsulate it into one nice, neat nugget. I would probably just say, one, be yourself. Well, maybe that is one. Be yourself. Always be yourself. Be true to self, might be the phrase. Be true to self. And secondly, take every opportunity. Because that's what I've tried to do. I haven't done too badly on the back of it. And I think you can always look in the mirror then and say, you've done your best and you haven't let opportunities pass, unless they need to be let pass. But by and large, try and make the most of every single opportunity that you have. But do it when it's true to yourself. And that, I think, that's what I've done. And I think, you know, it hasn't stood me in too bad a stead so far.
Great advice right there. And you can now tell our audience where they can go and capture finding your book online. Whereabouts can they go order your book from?
Sure. It's on most Amazon everywhere. Or you can go to www.nuulagwalsh.com. So then you can find more information about the book, where to order, my launch video, and lots of other interesting articles. In fact, every article that I've ever written is housed there as well. I have built a one-page repository of everything. So, and I'm constantly going to upload there. So it's actually a one-stop shop for pretty much everything now. So NoolaGWalsh.com. And I made it myself, Kirsty. Built by myself, that website.
Oh, well done. What a moment to celebrate when you went live with that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, Nola, just want to extend a huge heartfelt thank you, thank you, thank you for joining me. I know it's the beginning of your day. It's the end of our day over here. But honestly, your insights, wisdom and experiences have truly enriched a great discussion. And I can't wait to dive into your book as well. It honestly has opened my mind to go, I need to find that time, sit down with a coffee and enjoy reading the pages because, yeah, understanding the human mind is just such a critical part of life for all of us to be able to be the best versions of ourselves and thrive and support others on our journey as well. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Kirsty. It's been an absolute pleasure and a lot of fun. So thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us on this incredible odyssey. Until next time, lead with courage, lead with heart, and keep exploring the remarkable world of leadership. Enjoyed the journey? Hit the subscribe button, rate us, and leave a review if our stories ignited your leadership spirit. Your feedback fuels our odyssey.